I'm taking time, she thought hopefully. Through the crowd, she could see more red coats and tall, tufted hats. The thump, thump, thump of the drums was getting closer. A flash of movement caught her eyes. Aaron was gesturing at her to drop her hand. Joan had been too slow. Joan pushed down the beginnings of panic. What if she couldn't figure this out? Breathe, Aaron murmured. You just need to concentrate. He moved away again, putting a man between them. He held up his water bottle, and Joan reached over the man's shoulder for it. The new man was heavyset, with dark hair. Joan let the edge of her hand shift against his neck. Concentrate, she told herself fiercely. She squeezed her eyes shut. She wasn't here in a crowd outside Buckingham Palace. She was at home in Milton Keynes. It was a school morning. Monday morning. She imagined fumbling with the alarm, pulling on her blue and mustard uniform. The bell on Monday afternoon, Tuesday, then Mr. Larcher's noisy history class on Wednesday, Thursday, the happy sound of the last bell on Friday afternoon, then Monday again, Wednesday again, Friday again. Nothing happened. Joan tightened her grip on the bottle. She was trying her hardest, and it still wasn't working. She opened her eyes and shook her head at Aaron. She moved to shift away from the man, and then she was choking on it. Time ran into her like a jolt of strong coffee, like butterflies before an exam. Energy, intense and insistent, flowed through her. It felt horrible. It felt incredible. Someone was there suddenly. Aaron. He tugged her hand, guiding it away from the man's neck. Are you all right? He asked. Joan breathed out shakily. She nodded. Aaron took time as naturally as breathing. Joan struggled with every take. She knew she was being too slow. She could see Aaron becoming more and more tense as the ceremony drew closer. His eyes were everywhere, tracking every phone, scanning the crowd. As the guards reached the palace, the crowd became so dense that it was difficult to move. Joan slowed down even more. She took time, then painstakingly shifted and squeezed to the next person. She tried to concentrate on the mechanical act of it, but as she did, she found her mind returning to the guilt room. To Nick's grave face as he'd said, if you ever steal time from a human again, I will kill you myself. I won't hesitate. She was stealing time from these people. She was a monster. She felt so fucking ugly inside, and at the same time, she wanted to scream at Nick. Why did you have to kill my family? The next man was wearing a hoodie. Strange for such a warm day. Joan pushed the hood aside. There was a tattoo on the back of his neck. A snarling wolf. Joan gasped. She'd seen that wolf before. The man in the maze had had the same tattoo. This man turned fast, perhaps feeling the cool air on his neck. He reached for Joan, but she was already propelling herself into the crowd. She could hear him struggling after her as she muscled herself through the crush of people to the low fence that cut off the memorial from the road. Stay behind the barricades, a cop shouted. Joan leaped over the barricade, ignoring the oi behind her. She sprinted across the street. Here, the crowd was even more dense. People were pressed 10 deep, right up against the palace fence. Someone grabbed Joan's arm. She threw a wild punch. It's me, it's me. Aaron looked weirdly disheveled. He'd lost the floppy hat somewhere. He dragged her farther into the crowd, toward the fence. They're here, Joan said. She looked over her shoulder, trying to pick them out from the crowd. They're here. I know. Aaron's grip tightened painfully around Joan's arm. Do you have enough time to go?
I don't know.
Was Nick here? Joan couldn't see the man with the tattoo. She couldn't see Nick. Aaron's grip shifted so that he and Joan were holding hands. It surprised Joan enough that she turned back to him. What are you doing?
We have to leave now.
But I don't know if I've taken enough time. Look, there.
Aaron pointed. He sounded as scared as Joan felt. There, there! People jumped over the barricades and ran toward them, a pack of wolves converging. I'll do destination, Aaron said, but you have to jump too. As long as we're holding hands, we'll go together. Are you ready? Joan nodded, even though she had no idea what she was actually supposed to do. Okay, now, Aaron said. Joan couldn't take her eyes off the men running toward them. Aaron had said to jump. She imagined herself jumping. Nothing happened. Do it, Aaron said. They're coming. Joan visualized jumping again. Nothing happened. I'm doing the hard part, Aaron said. You just have to jump. Joan jumped for real, jostling everyone around her. People turned and stared. What the hell are you doing? Aaron said. You said to jump through time. Joan heard herself make a sound that might have been a laugh and might just have been terror. She thought frantically back to that morning with Mr. Salt when he'd pushed her and day had turned into night. She couldn't remember doing anything. It had just happened. Nick's people were in the crowd now. Joan still couldn't see Nick. You need to go without me, she said. Don't be stupid, Aaron said. Jump. I don't know how. You annoying, backward, time-mired hunt. Jump! She imagined jumping again. Nothing. You have to go, she said. They're almost here. Look at me, Aaron said. It's too late. The sword wound in Joan's side ached, a reminder of how much this was going to hurt. You have to go. Don't look at them, Aaron said. Look at me. Joan swallowed and lifted her head to look at him. You can do this, Aaron said. His face was very serious. His eyes were grey, Joan thought distantly, like the sky before rain. You've done it before. You know how. I really don't, Joan whispered. Oh God, there were more people leaping over the barricades now. Aaron, you have to go. Look at me, Aaron said. Joan forced her gaze back to him. Yeah, just like that. Tell me why you were working at Holland House. What? What are you talking about? Holland House? You volunteered at Holland House. Aaron seemed so calm. Why? What are you talking about? Just think, Aaron said. Why? Why? Joan took a breath. I don't know. I don't know, okay? I just did. I like history. You like history? Yes, Joan said impatiently. Aaron, they're coming. You liked the recreations of history at the house, Aaron said. Yes. Holland House showed you another time, Aaron said, and you were drawn to it. It wasn't the real thing. It was just a cardboard cutout, but it was as close as you could get to being in another time. Joan stared at him. She remembered the first time she'd walked into the house. She'd loved it. Immediately and irrationally, it had been restored to its Georgian heyday, and Joan had felt as though she'd stepped into another time. Traveling to other times is your birthright, Joan, Aaron said. It's in your blood. You've been stuck here a long time, but you don't have to be. Remember the feeling you had when you first walked into the house, do you remember? Nick's people were almost upon them. Joan saw the shine of a knife. Do you remember? Aaron asked. Joan felt it again then, the yearning she'd felt when she'd first arrived at Holland House. Her heart wrenched with it. I remember, she whispered. The knife slashed toward her, and the world shifted. Chapter 8. For a long moment, Joan couldn't hear anything but her own harsh breaths. Nick's people had vanished. She pressed her hand against her throat, where the knife had been about to slash her. She turned her palm over. Her skin felt strangely tender with anticipated pain, but there was no blood. Nick's people were gone. The knife was gone. No, she was gone. Buckingham Palace seemed unchanged. People were still jostling for position to see the guards. The great statue of Victoria still sat on her throne. But the man beside Joan had an old-fashioned camera, its thick strap looped around his neck. A second ago, everyone had been holding up phones. Now no one was. And there were other differences too. Clothes were looser, hair was bigger. Joan took a breath. She was breathing air from another time. She was standing with people from another time. The sounds of the world came back in a rush. The drums, the trumpets, the marching footsteps of the guards. The ceremony was on top of them. No one seemed to have noticed that two people had arrived out of nowhere. "We did it." Joan could hear the muted shock in her voice. "We travelled."
"I travelled," Aaron said dryly, "dragging you along."
A woman nearby gave them both a curious look. Joan realised she was still holding Aaron's hand at the same moment he did. He tore his grip from hers as if she burned him. Joan rolled her eyes. The changing of the guard was ending now in a last thunder of drums and trumpets, and it was suddenly all too loud. A lifted camera made Joan flinch. She was safe, but her body didn't believe it. Not yet. She needed to breathe clear air. With effort, she pushed her way out of the crush until the crowd finally yielded and she found herself in open space. And then her breath stopped in her throat. Here, the past lay all around her. Cars circled the memorial in an unbroken stream, wide and boxy and low to the ground as she'd only ever seen in movies. She was in the past. She turned a slow circle, following the cars. She was in the past. On the horizon, there was an empty space where the London Eye should have been, a missing tooth on the skyline. The last turn brought her face to face with Aaron. He was watching her with an unexpectedly soft expression that disappeared as she focused on him.
"Have you finished staring?" His voice was studied boredom. "This is nothing. I do this all the time."
"Yes," Jane said. Her eyes returned to the piece of sky where the London Eye should have been. "No." The world felt infinite. She could go anywhere, any when. She could travel back to the Regency, to the Restoration, to the Roman Empire. She could see Pompeii before it fell. She could see... Then she remembered how they'd gotten here. She shuddered. No, she could never do that. Tourists strolled around them. Girls and boys snuck Aaron a second look. Even with his hair all messed up, he was good-looking enough to turn heads. If these people only knew what he was, what Joan was, what she'd just fantasized about doing, they'd run screaming from them both. Joan took a step toward the road and then realized that she'd started for the tube to get to Gran's house in Kensington. She stopped, disoriented. Gran moved every year. Here, in this time, Joan had no idea where the Hunt family lived. She had no idea where anyone was. When she'd imagined going back in time, she'd imagined going back a few days to warn everyone. Now, she was decades in the past, before she was even born. She wished suddenly that she could go home. Not to Gran's. Home, home. To Dad's, in Milton Keynes. She'd tell him everything, and he'd make a big pot of rice porridge with lots of ginger, like he did when she was sick. They'd scoop it into the little bowls from the top of the cupboard. Dad would crack an egg into Joan's bowl, and he'd tell her that everything would be okay. But there was no home in this time. Right now, Dad was still living in Malaysia. He hadn't moved to England yet. If Joan went home to Milton Keynes, a stranger would answer the door.
"Are you about to lose it?"
Aaron sounded more curious than concerned.
"No," Joan said, "because you look like you're freaking out."
"Yeah, well, I'm not," Joan said. It came out as embarrassingly emphatic. She expected Aaron to mock her, but his eyes turned back to the clumps of tourists.
"We can't stay here," he said. "We just appeared out of thin air. Someone might have noticed."
No one was even looking at them.
Around them, people were either following the marching guards or peeling away. But of the two of them, Aaron knew this world. Aaron knew people here. Joan needed him. She hated that she needed him. Aaron turned towards St. James's Park. The relieved guards were marching back down the long red stretch of the Mall. Thinning streams of tourists followed them, still taking photos with those big, boxy cameras. "Wait," Joan said, and only realized she'd spoken when Aaron turned back to her. "Where are we going?" she said. "We can't go to your family." Aaron was silent for so long that Joan thought he wasn't going to answer at all. "I know," he said finally. His expression was closed off. Joan waited for him to elaborate, but instead he started again toward the park. Joan stared at his back for a long moment before following. It was a sunnier day than the one they'd left. St. James's Park was a patchwork of picnic blankets and deck chairs and people eating sandwiches and soft serves. Conversation blended with kids shrieking and a tinny cricket match streaming from someone's... Joan blinked, coming from a silver box the size of a bread bin. This wasn't her London, she remembered again. After that, all she could see were differences. The drape of people's clothes, the haircuts, even the air smelt different in this time, like cigarettes and tar. The cars sounded different. When Joan closed her eyes, she could have been in a different city. And something inside her was drawn to it, just as she'd been drawn to Holland House. She wanted to keep travelling, to see London grow stranger and stranger until there wasn't even a London here anymore, and then to keep going beyond that, to see the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, or to travel forward, to see wonders. "Time travel is in your blood," Aaron had said. "Hey," Aaron's hand clamped over her arm. Joan blinked at him, feeling weirdly muzzy. His grip hurt, but in the same distant way that her arm had hurt the time she'd broken it and Dr. DeWitt had prescribed a wildly strong painkiller that had made her head float. Aaron's face was right up close then, eyes wide. "Joan?" His voice sounded far away, as though he was speaking through a long pipe. "Hey, stay with me." "Shouldn't," she mumbled. "Your family tried to kill me." At school, Mr. Larch had said that there were once elephants and camels in St. James's Park, and crocodiles. King Charles II had played French croquet here, and before that, it had been a hunting ground. Wild deer and ducks for the king's table. "Joan!" The suddenness of Aaron's voice jolted her again. "Are you with me? Can you hear anything?" "Can you hear your stupid voice?" Her own voice came out weirdly dreamy. Aaron's small smile hit her right in the gut. It was unfair for him to be so good-looking, she thought distantly, when he was so disagreeable all the time. "Can you feel me touching you?" he said. His hand was on her arm. Joan opened her mouth to say that of course she could feel it. But the truth was, she could hardly feel her body at all. And Aaron's voice was the only thing she could hear clearly. Where a moment ago the park had been full of bird chatter and people talking, now everything seemed muffled. Panic stirred inside her, but even that felt far away and cotton-wooled. "What's happening?" she mumbled. "You're all right," Aaron said, "but you need to listen to me very carefully. You have to stay in the moment, this moment. Pick out one detail from the park. What can you hear?" "I don't." She tried to pick out a thread from the muffled mess of her senses, but everything wisped away like smoke. "I don't know." "I can hear the wind in the trees," Aaron said. And again, his voice was the only clear thing. "Now you." Joan struggled to focus. There was a sound floating above the others, something high and sweet.
She had to struggle even harder to find the word that went with it.
Bird, she managed. It was like talking underwater.
She saw Aaron's hand tighten, but she still couldn't feel it.
Good, he said. What else? I can hear people talking.
Joan made another exhausting effort. It was like being stuck inside a dream, unable to wake up.
Cars.
One more. Joan struggled again.
Water.
Fountain. She wasn't sure how long they stood there together, naming sounds in the park. Aaron's hand gradually solidified against her skin, temperature coming back first so that she felt the warmth of him before anything else. The conversations around them re-emerged and then got louder and louder, like someone was turning the volume up. Joan took a breath that tasted like bitter rubber and fuel and nearly choked on it. Aaron squeezed her arm, and this time she definitely felt it.
There, he said. There you are.
Joan took another choking breath. The fog in her head was clearing. She shook her head, trying to clear it faster. What's going on?
You nearly died.
What?
You tried to travel without taking time fast.
No, Joan said, confused. I took time at the pit. I must have had some left over.
It doesn't work like that, Aaron said. Once you jump, it's gone. You jumped and then you tried to jump again. You didn't know how to put on the brakes.
No, I just felt...
All Joan had felt was a yearning, a pull in her chest. The same pull she'd felt in the pit.
But if that was how you jumped, how were you supposed to stop yourself from traveling accidentally? How could you stop yourself from feeling a feeling?
You should eat something, Aaron said. Food from this time will ground you. Until then, you need to focus on the details. Smell, sound, temperature. Stay in the present. Don't think about anything but now.
But when was now? Suddenly, Joan had to know. She pulled away from Aaron with an almost frantic desperation. She had to find something, anything with a date. There was a rubbish bin beside the path. She rifled through it, pushing aside empty crisp packets, the remains of sandwiches, half a galaxy bar. Aaron said. He sounded mildly horrified. When I said eat something, I didn't mean other people's refuse. Joan said absently. A Coke can, a crumpled Twiglets packet. No newspapers, no magazines. Damn.
Is this a human thing? Aaron said, caressing rubbish. I don't spend much time with humans.
I'm looking for...
Joan glared at him.
No, it's not a human thing. I'm looking for the date.
Aaron's eyebrows lifted. In the bin.
There might be a newspaper in there.
Joan was starting to feel defensive. In the movies, people always find the date in the newspaper. It happens in Doctor Who all the time. They do it in Back to the Future. What on earth is Back to the Future?
Joan bit her lip, but the laugh spluttered out of her, half hysterical. They'd travelled in time. Now she was here with this ridiculous posh boy who didn't even watch movies.
I failed to see what's so amusing, Aaron said.
What in the name of Eton is Back to the Future? Joan said. What is it? What is it, old bean?
Well, that's childish. I don't sound like that.
You sound exactly like that.
Aaron huffed.
Oh, take your hands out of the bin. We don't need a newspaper to determine the date.
He gave the picnickers and joggers a look of professional assessment. The kind of look that Ruth might give to a lock she was about to pick. It's 1993, he said.
Joan opened her mouth at his audacity. You can't know that just by looking.
Big hair, but not giant hair, Aaron said. And no neon. So we're not in the 80s. No Rachel haircuts either. So this must be pre-Friends. That's a window of 1990 to 1994. After that, it's easy enough to narrow it down. That man's phone, Aaron pointed out the guy, still chatting on his phone. BT Jade. It came out in 1993. So we could be in 1993 or 1994. But look at his watch. Look at his shoes. Brand new. He likes new things. It's 1993. Joan was impressed in spite of herself. Friends, she said. In the back of her mind, though, she was doing the sums. The Rachel haircut is a time marker, Aaron said, like St. Paul's or the New Globe. Why are you making that face? He scrunched his mouth. Joan could only assume he was mimicking her own expression.
You overshot, she said. We were only supposed to travel back 20 years.
So what if I did? Aaron folded his arms loftily. You're lucky we got out at all. You're an utter deadweight. But my point, he said, is that you don't need to rummage through other people's crisp packets as if you were a rabid squirrel. Joan could hardly hear him. She stared at their surroundings. Across the grass, St. James's Park Lake barely rippled. A woman walked by the lakeside with a pram. The baby would be an adult in Joan's time, older than Joan herself. That elderly man might be dead. And the strangest thing about it all was the absolute solidity of the world. The air smelled of cars and tar. The ground was hard under her feet. This was real. She was undeniably here, in a time before her own birth. What are we going to do? She said. We have to stop Nick. She felt a strange mix of urgency and helplessness. They were so far away from what had happened. We need to warn everyone about what's coming. And Nick wasn't here at all, she realized then. Not anywhere in the world in this time. She was surprised by her hollow feeling of loss. He hadn't been born yet. She could look for him everywhere, and he'd be nowhere.
Before we do anything, we need to eat, Aaron said. You almost travelled without taking time first. You almost died. Do you understand that? I always knew the Hunts were irresponsible, but failing to educate you in basic safety, don't talk about my family. Joan had meant to snap it, but it came out low and dangerous.
The secrets that had been kept from her felt like a raw place inside her. Just being with Aaron, seeing how easily he negotiated this world, made her feel even more raw. You, of all people.
Yes, me of all people indeed, Aaron said. Your family taught you a lot about the monster world, did they?
I know a bit, Joan said defensively.
Like what? Who can you trust in this time? You have no ID. Where are you going to get it? You have nowhere to sleep tonight, no money, no friends, and the Hunts are impossible to find.
I can take care of myself.
Which family's territory are we standing in right now? What does that mean? What are the king's laws? What happens if you break them?
Joan pushed down a wave of helplessness. She didn't want to have to rely on Aaron Bloody Oliver. His father had tried to kill her. Aaron would have let it happen. He'd just walked away.
You travelled in time, Aaron said. You're not in the human world anymore. If you want to survive, then you'll need to learn about the monster world very fast.
I wish it were from anyone but you.
She hadn't meant to say it out loud, but it was true.
Oh, believe me, I know.
Aaron turned and started walking again. Chapter 9. Signs of the 90s were everywhere. Brick walls papered with Jurassic Park posters and the fluttering rags of older ones. Groundhog Day. Nirvana. The cars, the clothes, even the traffic lights looked different. It was like, and yet so unlike, the London that Joan knew. The police were fancy dress versions of themselves, all in bobby hats and smart jackets. People's clothes were baggy and strange. Aaron led Joan through Covent Garden, head raised as though he owned the whole city. At some point, he'd transformed himself from a dowdy tourist back to a wealthy schoolboy. As he had last night, he avoided the main roads, taking shortcuts Joan hadn't known existed, through hidden courtyards and walled parks.
By the time he stopped, she was thoroughly lost. They could have been in Covent Garden or Temple or farther out. Aaron had brought them to a passage between buildings, narrow enough that Joan could touch the stone walls on both sides when she stretched. The sky was a thin strip of grey above. It was as cool as a cellar here. This part of London felt very old. Chimneys blew out woody smoke. There was a door in the wall, small and squat and black, with a brass plaque beside it, a sea serpent engulfing a sailing ship, the kind of image you might see on a medieval map to mark uncharted territory. "This is one of our inns," Aaron said. Joan touched the plaque. "Here be dragons," she said. Aaron's smile was amused, almost soft, as though he'd forgotten for a second that he didn't like her. Joan's stomach twisted strangely. She was nervous, she thought. "Is this your first time in a monster place?" he said. Joan wet her dry lips. She nodded. "Dragons need not fear other dragons," Aaron said, and Joan's stomach did that strange twist again. She knew that wasn't true. Aaron's own family had shown her that. But she took a deep breath and opened the door. Her first impression was of an old-fashioned pub, glossy wood and stained glass. There were tables in every nook, crammed with people in the clothes of a dozen eras. Laughter and conversation filled the room. But there were oddities, too. Rushes and herbs were strewn underfoot, and the air was smoky, almost barnyard. Joan could smell hay, crushed fennel, and lemon balm, as well as rosemary and rich roasting meat. A hearth in the corner held a bubbling cauldron of stew. Joan's stomach rumbled. Her next impression was almost of a cathedral. The far wall was a series of stained glass windows. In them, map monsters swam in an ocean of blue glass. A bearded fish, a spiny dragon, a great beast with scales and tusks. Blue light spilled from the windows, turning the wooden floor into rippling shallows. As Joan stood there, a man emerged from a back room. He was black with greying hair and a handsome, unlined face. He scanned the room with an air of authority and then strode over to two men, sandy-haired and muscular, sitting near the hearth. "Did I see money change hands in my inn?" His tone was calm. Joan was reminded of a school principal. She guessed he was the owner of this place. The two big men ducked their heads, seeming as chastened as scolded children. "Sorry, innkeeper, just offloading my phone," one of them said. "Does this look like a market?" The innkeeper gestured to the door. "Out." He didn't bother to watch the men go, although they did, scurrying obediently away. He turned his attention to Joan and Aaron, taking in their hairstyles, their shoes, the cut of their clothes. "Just arrived," he said. Aaron nodded. "Are there any rooms available?" "We'll find you something," the innkeeper said. "Rooms come with food," he added briskly. "Help yourself to bowls. Someone will bring you a key." Aaron led Joan to the hearth and took two bowls from the mantelpiece above it. He ladled stew from the cauldron. It smelled delicious, savory and rich. Joan could see carrots and onions and maybe duck. They found a table in an out-of-the-way corner. When Joan pulled the chair, it dragged against the floor, the sound momentarily rising above the chatter in the room. Aaron raised an eyebrow and shifted his own chair, silently, of course. He had the graceful precision of a cat. "Do we really need a room?" Joan said. She had imagined they'd just tell someone about the massacre, and that would be that.
"Food first," Aaron said. "You don't know how to ground yourself on your own yet. Eating food from a new time is an easy shortcut."
He blew in his own spoon and ate a bite.
"This is good," he said grudgingly.
So how will this work, then? Joan said. She ate her own stew. The flavours were unexpectedly Christmassy. Orange peel and cinnamon and cloves. She kind of liked the combination. Once we warn someone, will it just be like, she snapped her fingers, like last night never happened, like you and I won't even remember any of this happening? It was a strange thought. She and Aaron might never know that they'd once sat here alone at a table, eating a meal together, that they'd once helped each other. There was a plate of fresh bread on the table. Aaron took a roll and scored a cross in the crust. He pushed a pat of butter into the scoring and then passed the roll to Joan. He took another for himself. Eat that too. The bread was dense and very dark, and warm enough that the butter had already melted into it. Joan looked around as she chewed. Just like the city outside, the inn was familiar and strange at the same time. People stepped in and out of the air with casual ease, as if they were merely stepping from one room to another. At the closest table, two women were playing a game that looked like chess, but when Joan peered more closely, the pieces seemed wrong. An elephant. A medieval cannon. It was all so disorienting. And yet, some things were familiar. Joan licked butter from her thumb. It was heavily salted and as sour as yogurt. She'd only ever tasted butter like that at Gran's house. She bent to breathe in the familiar scent of it. We call it whole milk butter, Aaron said. She could have been eating Gran's food. My Gran makes butter like this. I thought it was a family thing. Aaron shrugged. It's a monster thing. A monster thing. When all this was over, when the events of last night were undone, maybe this taste would become a family thing again. And that was a strange thought, too. Maybe Joan would never learn that there was a greater context to these parts of her life, a culture. Laughter erupted at one of the tables. Hathaway's, Aaron said, sounding annoyed. The laughter was coming from a rowdy table in the centre of the room. There were a dozen people there. Like all the groups in the inn, the Hathaways seemed to be a mix of races. Their only real similarity was their muscular build. Men and women, both. Most of them seemed to have pets. Joan spotted a grey cat on a man's lap, a sleepy pug curled under a chair. As she watched, a black cat jumped onto the Hathaway table and stalked between cups and bowls. Joan opened her mouth to ask Aaron another question, but right then, a woman stepped out of the air near the Hathaway table. Her hairstyle was distinctive, curls at her forehead and coiled plaits at the back of her head. That woman's hair, Joan said slowly. Where had she seen hairstyles like that before? Aaron glanced over and shrugged. We really should eat before we talk. Joan answered her own question. Statues. Joan, Aaron said, keep eating. Ancient Roman statues. Joan. Aaron leaned in until all Joan could see was his face. You're right, he said. From her hairstyle, I would say she arrived from circa 100 AD. His voice took on an almost seductive quality. I went there once, you know, to the temple of Venus on Velian Hill. It was such a hot day that the flower offerings wilted in their vases. The perfume of roses and myrtle was like wine. What? Joan tried to focus on him. Her head felt muzzy. The stream of worshippers didn't stop, Aaron said. There were so many offerings that jewellery and flowers piled up on the floor. The smoky hearth was losing its scent. Stop it, Joan said thickly. Newlyweds brought in a bull with gilded horns, Aaron said. I stayed for the sacrifice. Do you want to hear about that? No. She felt as though she were falling. What had Aaron told her at St. James's Park? Focus on the details. She puts her palm shakily against the table. She could barely feel the wood. Her throat contracted in a terrified sound that she couldn't hear. Details. There were scratches in the gloss of the table. Beside one of the bowls, Aaron's fist was clenched tight enough to whiten his knuckles. There was a shallow cut on Joan's own hand across her thumb. That must have happened in the sword fight. The smell of the hearth returned slowly until the air was smoky enough to make Joan cough. "Why did you do that to me?" she demanded. Aaron smiled slightly, but his eyes were flat. "Right now, anyone could do that to you. A Jane Austen book cover could do that to you. What is wrong with you?" "What is wrong with me?" Aaron had the gall to sound irritated. "I'm trying to help you." He added, conceding, "You did well that time. You came back from it quickly." The problem was he looked so much like a human boy that Joan kept expecting him to act like one. But he wasn't a human boy. He was a monster raised by monsters. "You know what?" She stood up. "I don't want your help." He'd brought her here to this time. She didn't need anything more from him than that. "Where are you going?" he frowned. "Just don't," she said. "Don't help. Don't do anything else for me." She felt his eyes on her as she walked away. Joan had noticed a flow of people coming and going near the back, even though the signs for the lavatory pointed the opposite way. Sure enough, there was a back door. Joan opened it, expecting another nondescript laneway. But to her surprise, it opened onto a cobblestoned square with bow-fronted shops and tall brick buildings. "Front door," she revised. Streets led away from the square. Looking down one of them, Joan saw more buildings and what looked like a park that ended in a wall. Joan imagined that wall enclosing all this. A monster place, she thought, hidden away. It had started to rain while Joan had been inside. Now big splotches were falling onto the cobblestones, darkening them. The sky had greyed. Here and there, people popped in and out of existence. The ones appearing ducked their heads from the rain and scrambled into buildings. Joan stopped one woman as she hurried toward the inn. "Excuse me," she said. "Do you know where I can find the Hunt family?" The woman's eyebrows drew together. "What do you want with those thieves?" She pushed past Joan roughly and went inside. Joan stared after her, shaken. The Olivers hated her family. Had the woman been an Oliver? Or did lots of people hate the Hunts? It was an unsettling thought. Around the square, there were all kinds of shops selling cakes, tea, jewellery. One seemed to specialise in hats, seemingly of every era. Top hats, floral hats, straw bonnets, baseball caps. Another sold confectionery, its window display a cornucopia of whole glacé pineapples and oranges. Interspersed among the fruit, there were sugar sculptures. A translucent tiger. A brightly coloured parrot. They were lit from within by what looked like real, shifting flames. Joan had never seen anything like them. She walked on. About half the new arrivals were hurrying out of the rain and into the inn. Many of the others headed in another direction, running down one of the streets. The rain started to properly pelt down. Joan jogged across the cobblestones, following them. Water splashed up from puddles, soaking her ankles. The trail of people led her to a covered market with a grand Victorian facade. Above the open entrance, the name Ravencroft Market was carved in stone, along with three-dimensional birds and leaves. Joan walked in. The floor inside was a continuation of the cobbled street. An ornate glass ceiling arched above, the colour of a summer sky. Here and there, leadwork ravens soared among the glass. Joan's hair dripped as she passed racks and racks of clothes. She could have walked out of the market as a Roman centurion, or a lady of the Regency, or a 90s grunge. There was food, too. An eel and pie stall, a curry stall. Joan's stomach rumbled again. She wished she'd taken the bread roll with her. She continued past tables of spices and herbs, homemade bottles labelled garum, bunches of spiky banana-like fruit, dried yellowish leaves labelled silphium, unfamiliar chocolate bars. It reminded Joan of the Chinese grocer she and Dad went to, a place to get things that weren't on the high street. Garum, she thought idly. That had been a condiment in ancient Rome, a little like fish sauce. Joan had read about it. And just like that, the muzzy feeling was back. Focus, Joan told herself, pushing down fluttering panic. Focus on details. But everywhere she looked, there were objects from other times. A centurion shield slung over someone's back. A rough wooden bow unstrung. Oi, someone called out. Joan jumped, startled out of the muzziness. A stall owner was looking at her, a man in his early 20s. He had sandy hair and the muscular build of a boxer. "You selling that contraband?" he said. "Contraband?" Joan said. The man's card table was covered with bulky 90s phones and watches, cameras and other electronics. The man gestured at the phone poking out of Joan's jeans pocket. "You're in the 90s, love. Drop that thing outside these walls and you'll hear about it from the court, but I'll take it off your hands." It was the phone Joan had found in the yellow drawing room. She'd almost forgotten about it. "You have the passcode?" the man asked. Joan shook her head. "I'll give you 100 for it." A flash of memory came to Joan of Gran buying a sausage roll at Greg's one day. Gran had winked at Joan and then offered the man half the asking price for it. At the time, Joan had squirmed with embarrassment. Who did that? Now, she just wished Gran were here. 500, Joan said for the hell of it, because the audacity of it would have made Gran laugh.
Oh, fuck off, the guy said. You think I'm running a charity?
200, Joan said. Screen's not even cracked. The guy grimaced.
170, he said. No more than that.
He jerked his chin.
I'd give you more for that necklace, though.
Joan reached instinctively to touch the chain. Gran had given her the necklace last night before she'd died. Joan swallowed and shook her head.
Go on, the man said. Name a price.
It was the only connection Joan still had to Gran. Gran had touched this chain. Gran's blood had been on this chain. Joan shook her head again. The man shrugged.
Suit yourself.
He handed Joan some strange notes, and Joan gave him the phone in return. She examined the notes curiously. They were clear plastic with golden images at their centre. A crown, a winged lion. Laid over each other, they seemed to form part of an unfamiliar coat of arms. Was this monster money?
Can I have some of this in local cash?
She asked, partly to gauge the exchange rate.
What am I, a currency exchange? The guy grumbled.
But he took back a 20 and gave Joan £40 in more recognisable money. Joan pocketed the cash. As she turned, a familiar voice drawled.
Well, look at you, selling stolen goods like a true hunt.
Aaron was standing by the table, arms folded casually. But his hair was wet and dark like it had been last night after his shower. Had he run out here looking for her? Aaron surveyed the man's watches and phones with clear disdain.
Hope you're not going to spend it here, he said to Joan.
I'm going to the post office down the street, Joan said. I saw the sign. It said they deliver to other times. I'm going to write myself a letter.
What on earth for?
To stop Nick, of course, Joan said, to warn myself so I can save my family. Aaron barked a laugh, spontaneous and harsh. Why is that funny? Joan demanded, even though Aaron hadn't sounded amused exactly. If anything, the laugh had sounded pained. She had an uneasy feeling suddenly, like the feeling she'd had when she'd taken time at the pit.
Oh, it's not funny at all.
Aaron gestured for Joan to lead the way.
By all means, write a letter and save us all from heroes.
The uneasy feeling increased as Joan went back out into the rain. Aaron followed her in silence. The post office wasn't far, but by the time they got to it, water was falling from the eaves in sheets, spattering as it hit the ground.
Oh, you two got caught in it,
the woman at the post office said when Joan pushed open the door. She had a soft northern accent that reminded Joan of Nick. She was sorting what looked like wedding invitations, popping them into different drawers, labelled with 50-year ranges, 1900 to 1949, 1950 to 1999, 2000 to 2049. She gestured.
Postcards over there, she said. Lovely one of Steffi Graf, winning Wimbledon this year.
Could I send a letter, please? Joan said.
A letter, the woman said. Isn't that nice? Love a letter. More people should write letters.
She gestured at a shelf with sheets of paper and envelopes. Joan could feel Aaron's eyes on her. The post office was set up like a little living room. There was a love seat and a low coffee table in a pink painted alcove. Joan sat on the love seat and, after a moment, Aaron's weight settled beside her. Joan breathed out. Dear Joan, she wrote. It felt strange to address herself. She hadn't realized how difficult it would be to write out the events of last night. Her hand shook as she told herself how the Olivers had arrived, how she'd sent a message to her family, how the Hunts had come to help her and how they'd died. She told herself about Nick. Aaron's gaze on her felt like a physical presence as she wrote. It was going to be okay, she thought to herself. After this letter was delivered, last night wouldn't have happened. As soon as her past self got the letter, she'd prevent the massacre. She'd warn Gran and her family. They'd all stop Nick together.
Do you think I need to say anything else? She whispered to Aaron.
He hadn't spoken since they'd left the market, but he'd been reading over Joan's shoulder. Now he said heavily, No. Joan signed her name. Then she took a deep breath and went back to the counter. At what point would time reset itself? Would it be when she handed the letter to the woman at the counter? When it was delivered? The woman took the letter and one of Joan's strange monster banknotes and handed over some change, more notes and coins. Now, Joan thought, she'd be back at home with Gran and everyone would be alive again now. Outside, the rain continued to pelt down. Seconds ticked by.
Can I please send a copy to my Gran as well? Joan said.
The woman showed her how to use the copier. Joan wrote down Gran's address from the last year and a date for last summer. The woman took back some of the coins. Now, Joan thought, it was all going to be undone now. The woman put both letters into the 2000 to 2049 drawer.
You're sure this will be delivered at the right time? Joan said.
Guaranteed. All your money back, the woman said cheerfully.
Now.
Now.
Now. Nothing. The clock on the wall ticked off the passage of time. Nothing changed.
Can I help you with anything else? The woman said.
Joan startled when Aaron touched her elbow.
No, thank you,
Aaron said to the woman. To Joan, he said,
Why don't we go back to the inn? Joan almost imagined something gentle in his voice. Joan's unease grew as she opened the door out into the rain again, until the feeling was thick and heavy in her stomach, until it was so strong that she had to stop in the middle of that strange, hidden, trafficless street with the rain pouring down on her. "Joan," Aaron said. To her surprise, he walked out from under the eave to join her. His white shirt turned sodden, sticking to his skin. She could see the edge of a dark tattoo just where his hip started. "Is the post office a scam?" Joan said. "Is that why you laughed at me?"
"I didn't," Aaron said.
"I didn't laugh at you. And it's not a scam. The post office sends messages to different times."
"Then how long do we have to wait?"
"Let's go inside," Aaron said.
The gentleness was back in his voice. "We have a room upstairs. We can dry off up there." Joan's hair felt heavy and cold down her back. The bandage was a clear outline around her waist. She knew why she was standing out here. The rain was soothingly relentless. She didn't know why Aaron was standing with her. He was thoroughly drenched now, too. She hadn't known him long, but she knew that he liked to look ordered and in control.
"If I ask you a question, will you tell me the truth?" she said.
Water dripped from Aaron's darkened hair, his shirt sleeves, the cuffs of his trousers.
"Yes."
"Will those letters save our families?" The tired pity in his eyes made Joan's throat close up. He shook his head. The sound of the rain drowned out his voice so that his answer was only a shape on his lips. "No." The unease inside her felt like a clawing animal. Her throat felt so tight she could barely speak. She forced out the next words. "Then how do we save them?" The pity in Aaron's face deepened into something awful and weary and old. And Joan suddenly didn't want him to answer. She was already shaking her head when he did.
"Nothing you do will save them," he said.
"No," Joan said. "No. That didn't make sense. There were 1,000 things she could do now that she was here in this time. She could warn Gran face to face, or she could hire a law firm to deliver messages to herself and her family to every one of Gran's addresses every year. She had years and years to find ways to stop that night from happening. Nick wouldn't catch anyone by surprise. No one would die. That made sense."
"Joan,"
Aaron said. But Joan suddenly couldn't bear his presence. "No," she said. She turned and ran, skidding and slipping on the wet cobblestones. She could hear him calling after her, but she didn't want to hear anything else he said. He was a liar. He'd left her to die last night. He was as cruel as his father. She wrenched open the door to the inn, peripherally aware of everyone turning to stare at her. She supposed she must look a fright, soaked to the skin and wild. She scanned the room, searching for familiar eyes, for the Hunt family look, for silver-tongued fox charms and tattoos, for any sign of her own family. There were dozens and dozens of people in here. One of them had to be a Hunt. All she needed was to find Gran's younger self in this time, to find any Hunt in this time. She just needed to tell them face to face. No letters, no middlemen. That would stop all this. She headed to where the innkeeper was standing behind a glossy wooden bar. He was sipping coffee, eyes on his patrons. Joan had the impression of a benevolent mayor. "I need to find someone from the Hunt family," Joan said.
The innkeeper gave her a long look.
"The Hunts don't like to be found."
Joan fumbled for the cash in her pocket and put a transparent and gold note on the bar, the one that said 50.
"Dorothy Hunt," she said.
That was Gran's name.
Some people shouldn't be found.
Joan put another 50 down. Any hunt will do, she said. But if Dorothy is in this time, then I want to talk to her.
The innkeeper made a sound at the back of his throat that might have been disapproval, but when Joan looked down, the cash was gone.
Joan had hoped that the clawing feeling inside her would be eased by that, but if anything, it worsened it. She scanned the room yet again. She knew it was stupid to keep checking, but she saw the tattoo first. A delicate mermaid curled around a man's wrist. She lifted her eyes to his face. She'd only seen him once before, but he was shockingly familiar. He'd been in his 50s when he'd died in the garden at Holland House. Now he was in his early 20s, and he had a round boyish face, a smirky mouth, and blonde hair that was already thinning. For a long moment, the overlaid image was more real than the inn. She could see it all, the dark garden at Holland House, the maze ahead of her, this man lying on his side, eyes open, one arm flung out, his mermaid tattoo stark against his pale wrist. The scent of crushed flowers seemed to fill the inn. He'd been there. She could warn him. There was a gust of cold, wet spray as the door opened and closed. Joan was distantly aware of Aaron saying her name urgently, but she was already moving. The man looked up as Joan approached him, his curious expression turning to distaste as he took in Joan's bracelet, the gold fox charm with its little silver tongue. I know. Joan raised her hands placatingly. I know I'm a Hunt. I know you're an Oliver. But listen to me, please. Something terrible is going to happen, but we can stop it. The man pushed his chair away. Joan grabbed at his sleeve as he stood. Wait, she said. Listen to me. Listen. A human is going to be born. He's going to kill so many people. He's going to kill you. Just like in the post office, she found herself thinking, now. Now. Last night will be undone. Now. As she told him the details of the date, the place, the time, all the people who would die. And just like at the post office, nothing changed at the end of it. She was doing this all wrong. She could feel it. She was saying the wrong things. She could feel herself breaking unspoken rules, conventions she didn't understand. But she couldn't stop. She was sure that if she just said the right thing in the right way, if she could make him understand, then everything would be fixed. There was a change in the quality of light. Joan knew without looking that Aaron had slipped into the space behind her. She had the feeling that he was blocking her from the view of other patrons. Tell him, she begged Aaron. Surely an Oliver would listen to another Oliver.
Aaron, the man looked Aaron up and down, mouth twisted in a sneer. Does the head of our house know that his son is slumming it at the Serpentine Inn with a Hunt? Or have you fallen even further than we'd imagined?
Aaron's hand shook slightly as he went